So we're going to talk about dining with Shakespeare, what went on in the Elizabethan era, what did they eat, how did they eat it, etc., and what did they think about food. This particular painting right here was a painting that Elizabeth gave to Francis Walsingham, who was her security officer and secretary. It has Henry VIII, obviously, in the middle, and Elizabeth to the right, with Mary to the left, and the little boy, you can hardly see him, that would have been Henry VIII's son, Edward. In the recent election campaigning, a reporter asked Mrs. Clinton if she could invite one author to dinner. Three authors. Which three would she pick? And she said she would only pick one, Shakespeare, and she'd be very interested to see who showed up. Now, for those of you not in the loop, there is an ongoing controversy. It's actually been going on for a long time, centuries, about who William Shakespeare really was. Was he the traditional man from Stratford who spelled his name with an X, if he could write it at all? He can write it, but they're not sure he actually is literate, some people. Or was it someone else, more like Edward de Vere, the 17th Earl of Oxford? Now, funny beginning, I'm sure you're asking yourself, from a culinary point of view, does it really matter? And the answer is, of course, yes, or I wouldn't mention it. Because Stratford Will is a commoner, and de Vere is the highest ranking earl in the land, and his food references are aristocratic and royal. They're not common kinds of things. If you're a commoner, these are how much you'd make in a day in the 16th century, and you can see that they're all grossly underpaid compared to the nobleman, who makes 1,600 pence a day. Now, that doesn't mean much to us until we see what you can buy with that. You can get a groundling admission to the Globe Theater for 1 pence. That would be a domestic's 3/4 of her day, or his day. And then you keep going as you get down to the spices, it gets more and more expensive. Commoners, which would be laborers, the poor, ate more dairy products and greens and far less meat. They also drank a lot of beer because, of course, the water was unsatisfactory most of the time. But they diluted their beer, so they called it small beer. Even kids drank it. If they lived near a great house or a palace where it was virtuous not to clean your plate or your trencher, as they called it, because the scraps on your plate were served to the poor. So if your eyes were bigger than your stomach, as my mother used to say, no problem. Now, Shakespeare, whoever he was, refers to food and banqueting more than 1,000 times in his plays and poems. And sometimes the references are literal, but a lot are metaphorical. Here's two comments in Merry Wives of Windsor. The wife bid these gentlemen welcome. Come, we have a hot venison pasty to dinner. So that would be a very literal one, versus we hope we shall drink down all unkindness, when he's using it in a more literary way. I happen to love Taming of the Shrew. I've probably seen it 30 times. Anyway, Petruchio, one of his speeches, he says that he's going to turn Caterina into a Kate, like any other household Kate. And of course, I assumed it was cat all these years. No, it does mean cat, but it also means the choicest morsel in the larder was called Kate. Something new. He uses banqueting to comment about social stability or the lack thereof. In Hamlet, Hamlet finds out his mother has married his uncle, and he says, well, how efficient, we can reuse the funeral feast as a wedding feast. In Macbeth, which is this picture that is on the screen, in Macbeth, in the very middle of the play, there's this banquet scene where Banquo's ghost comes. And at the beginning of the scene, everyone's told, come in, you know your degrees. In other words, you know your level in society and therefore where you would sit. You didn't need a place card. Everybody knew the ranking order in the society. But after Banco's ghost comes in, Macbeth gets into a frenzy. Lady Macbeth says, "Don't stand on your titles. Just go in any order, rather than leaving with the higher ranking people leaving first." One of my favorites is Taming of the Shrew, especially if you've seen Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton's film. The first part of the story ends with the marriage and the marriage banquet of Petruchio and Caterina. There's a lot of hostility. In the middle of the banquet, he says, "I'm leaving, I'm going home," and she's running after him and that sort of thing. Doesn't look like a very good situation. At the end of the play, she is admirable. She has understood his jokes. She knows how to play her husband, and he kind of knows how to play her. And it works fairly smoothly at the end. In one of the things that you see twice sometimes when it's performed is that at Caterina's wedding, her husband's servant walks out with this big ton of gold coins. And I've seen it done where at the end of the second act, they do the same thing because there was a bet, and they won. So it tells you a lot about banqueting. And actually, I learned that banqueting didn't always mean that big thing where everybody sits and there's a head table and everything. It also meant at the 16th century that it was a few people going into a separate room for dessert. So I got a little bit of a mixed message with that one. And if you were even at an aristocratic or royal feast, a person could be reminded of his lowly status by serving him humble pie, an expression I'm sure we have all heard. And it meant that you were sitting in the back of the room and they were giving you a pie. They did a lot in pastries, the less succulent pieces of whatever the good pieces were taken from. The most interesting thing I found when doing the research for this was that Shakespeare used food to reflect contemporary attitudes. I was amazed to discover that in the 16th century there were all sorts of recipe books and dietary books that gave you all sorts of advice, like Joanne and I laughed at this, not to eat your heaviest foods first, since the bottom of the stomach was the hottest and you wouldn't digest them. I think we would know this one. Don't recline or exercise after eating, because then all the food is just slushing around in your stomach somehow. And sad to say, drinking between the evening meal and bedtime cools the digestive process and is thus unhealthy. Now, I want you all to put those into your daily routines. An awful lot of medicine and attitudes in this time period were from Galen's theory of the four humors. Galen was an ancient thinker, and there were four elements, there were four seasons, and there were personalities. And he had them all coordinated. Anyway, we still do it. Like, we call pepper hot. You can touch it, it's not hot, right? And we called wine dry. Well, it's pretty wet, actually, you know? So we have these words in our language that we don't really think about anymore, but they're actually left over from Galen's ideas of humors. And of course, you needed to keep your humors in balance. If you were ill, it meant your humors were out of balance. So you don't want to give horseradish to choleric people. They're angry and arrogant enough already. And yet you want something for a phlegmatic person that would bounce this person out of its sluggishness. And sanguine people should eat sharp sauces made of vinegar and onions and barberries, which I had to look up. It's currants. And your humors are affected by what kind of animals you're choosing to eat, because they have humors, and their humors then come into you. And then Joanne, when we were in Florida for a winter, a couple months, she read a book on the biography of chicken. And I got two good things out of that. One was, of course, we know that chicken was a food for the sick and associated with cowardice. And she found the line, "Forthwith they fly like chickens." chickens weren't held in much esteem. But my favorite was the eggs. Apparently, a roasted egg was a raw egg was set down near the coals of the fire, and whoever was in charge of it had to turn it exactly at the right time to get it to cook. One cookbook from the 16th century had the idea that you should punch a hole in each end, put a bunch of them on a skewer, and then you could just rotate it over the fire. Another cooking book said that was just about the stupidest idea you'd ever heard of. And I don't know if you've ever tried to blow out an egg for like Easter kind of decorations and stuff, but it's not easy to do it without cracking the egg. So that idea of putting it on a rotating thing, that doesn't make sense to me either. And the way you cook things affects the humors. I mean, you just can't get away from it. So here's one guy, one of the books, that said, fried meat is harder of digestion than broiled meat is, and doth engender choler and melancholy. And, of course, we saw that, if you've seen Taming the Shrew or read it, when they get back to his house, and I don't know that he really believed what he was saying, but he was just giving her a hard time. I tell thee, cake 'twas burnt and dried away. I am expressly am forbid to touch it, for it engenders color, planteth anger, and better 'twere both that both of us did fast. And then he doesn't give her any dinner her first night in his castle or whatever he wants to call it. And food was also, and I don't think this is so strange, we've heard this a lot of times in history, that food could be an aphrodisiac. And shrimp, I don't know, we ate a lot of shrimp in Florida. I didn't see any sort of effect of any of this. asparagus, celery, parsnips. And those eringos there are sea holly. And I'm sure you've all heard of the seven deadly sins, and gluttony is one of the worst ones. That's a picture of supposedly a Falstaff. He was supposed to be real big. Gluttony is an enemy to health and the instrument of death. So they fasted a lot. And fasting was not like you just didn't eat. It was that you ate fish instead of meat. And they did this in early Christianity, too, because it was an economic thing, not a religious thing. They were trying to bulk up the fishermen's sales, sort of. Henry VIII got rid of fish on Friday kind of idea of the Catholic Church when he got rid of the Catholic Church. But Elizabeth revived it, and for the same reason the ancients did. And actually, a third of the year became meat-free. I would never have thought that. Now, this one man, he says, our English nature cannot live by roots, by waters, and herbs, and such beggary baggage. Give Englishmen meat. Well, he might have had to pay the fine if you ate meat on a fish day. So you could get 3 months imprisonment. That doesn't sound very good. Or 3 pounds in, fine. The problem is that a laborer would work 6 months for that. Of course, laborers didn't get much meat anyway, so maybe it didn't apply. I don't know. There is a comment in Love's Labour's Lost where the King of Navarre invites his lords to a 3-year fast, with nothing one day of the week and one meal the rest of the time, so that they weren't bankrupt of wits. I don't know whether eating affects our minds. I guess it does. Now, fish and meat could easily be obtained in England. They also consumed a lot of beer. If you didn't live in London, you probably had a servant whose whole job was to make the beer. But even in London, by 1574, there were 58 ale makers and 33 beer breweries. That's a lot. You add those together. That seems like a very much a lot of beer was being consumed. I think we're even serving some back there, aren't we? When it came to wine, however, they didn't have any problem with their ancient enemy, France. In fact, they preferred French wines. And they also liked things, liquor from Spain. They drank sack. Sack is a fortified wine, usually white, but it could be red, and you put cognac in it. Anyway, we don't have that for us, one of the foods tonight. According to Falstaff, sack had two benefits. It warms the blood and dries the brain of dull and curdy vapors. Henry VIII spent 3,000 pounds a year, that would be a tenth of his annual income, on wine and ale. Maybe that's how he went from that skinny little guy that was the Prince of Wales to that great big man who was Henry VIII at the end of his life. When Elizabeth, as queen, visited Lord North's estate, North was trying to win her over that she'd give him a position. He purchased 6 hogsheads of claret. That would be 324 gallons, 1 hogshead of white wine, and 20 gallons of sack. This was just to entertain the queen and her retinue when they visited his estate. Okay, now that you're all limbered up, we have a quiz. We want to know who knows what a hutch pot is. That's what I thought. How about a fool in the food context? No.
Like gooseberry fool.
I think you might be a winner. Hang on. Kickshaws. Isinglass. Sippets. Sippets are real popular. And chewits. So, a fool is a fruity, custardy, like a trifle. So, a gooseberry fool would be like a trifle. And some of them are just different ways to say it. Like, hutch pot is hodgepodge. And I love kickshaws. It comes from the French word quelquechose. And isinglass, I seem to remember my mother calling like a thing you put over the bowls and stuff, isinglass, I don't know, but it's a gelatin kind of a thing. And sippets are little triangle toast pieces, which almost every dish I looked up had these sippets, and it was a way to sort of scoop up the way in the Middle East they'd use a pita or something like that. And I don't know exactly what a chewit would look like, but it's a tall, narrow pie. So this is one of the recipes that, that I found in all the books I looked at. The thing that strikes me about this is that only recently have people in the United States started putting dried fruit in with vegetables and meats. That's a fairly new, I don't remember that in the 50s or 60s. You see it has all these spices and things, cloves and mace and black pepper and caraway seeds. They started getting spices, with the Crusades and everything. But they went through a middleman. And so by the time of Elizabeth, they were getting their spices from Aleppo, that's Syria. And they got rid of the middleman, and so it was a little cheaper, okay? But if you've ever heard the story about how they bought spices to cover up rancid meat, that is totally not true. If you could afford the darn meat, you could afford to throw it away if it was rotten. You wouldn't put that on. And the people who might have nothing but maybe rotten, they couldn't afford the spices to cover it up. So that just doesn't work. And eating well then, as it does now, is an expensive proposition. While she was staying at the house called Hatfield, she spent £119, 13 shillings, and 7.5 pence for fruits and spices. And her favorite, Robert Dudley, he bought various kinds of fruit. And I was typically, he thought the imported plums were better than the English plums. And that's, I don't know, that's a culinary snob or something that they think that, you know, the one is so much better just because it comes a long way. I don't know what you call them. They did not have foods that we take for granted because the New World had not impacted England as much as yet. They didn't have chocolate. They didn't have coffee. They had no tea, no tomatoes, no white potatoes, bananas, pineapple, or vanilla. They would have them fairly soon after the 16th century, but not at that particular time. It's interesting, I'm going to be doing a class on the Tudors too, and it's interesting to note why a court behaves the way it does. England didn't have a lot of population. It was kind of the poor boy of Europe, because it's way off there, that poor island. And one of the things that Elizabeth wanted to do is really send the message that we are an important country. And so she follows that thing about dressing to impress people. And getting dressed was a major two-hour operation for her. And she got even more involved in that as she got older and, you know, her face was less attractive. She was hoping to get you to see her clothing instead of her face. Well, you not only had to dress to impress, but all Europe talked about how those English people know how to eat. They really knew, put on a spread if you were there as an ambassador or something. And you'd bring your own knife. You'd bring your own knife. Even women would have a knife right here in your belt or in a little bag or something. So you'd bring your own knife, and you were given a little white napkin. You'd put it over your left shoulder because most of what you were doing was eating with your fingers. So you could take that little sippet we were talking about, get it into whatever it is, pop it in your mouth, and if you just wipe them off like this, see? I think this is the funniest thing. The tables had so many dishes on them, anywhere from 35 to 50 different dishes. So it was like a buffet, but it was on your table. You didn't rise and pick it off of a buffet table. They didn't have room for goblets. So there was a servant over here at a little table, and the servant would, gesture to him. He'd bring you a goblet of wine. And when you were done, he took your goblet back, swished it around in a bucket of water, and took it to someone else. And forks weren't common. There's a line in Anouilh's play Becket, where Becket tells Henry II, which would be 12th century, that he was had forks, and he was going to have everybody over for dinner, and he was going to have them use forks. And Henry took umbrage of that, and he said, well, what's the point? And he said, well, you can wash the forks. He said, I can wash my fingers. But that was very, very early. Really, forks did not really get going in England until the 1600s. But this little thing, which was called a sucket fork, S-U-C-K-E-T, was part of an inventory done when a noblewoman died. And she had a whole bunch of these, which looks pretty efficient. You just use either end of it, I guess. And but technically, they didn't use many forks. Don't have to. You got your fingers. Contrapositive thumb. Okay, so I am going to offer you a bibliography so you aren't a foul, undigested lump. One of his characters say, because some of these are really interesting, and they're either, actually the one in red is my favorite, and it is at the University of Michigan Library. Some of the others came from there too, and some I bought. So we invite you to come back to the back table and have some examples that people brought in. I'm going to be surprised what they are. I don't know what they were. and some beer.
Yes, non-alcoholic.
Non-alcoholic beer. They wouldn't let me bring.
Non-alcoholic beer will be served.
They wouldn't let me bring sack. I wanted to, but they wouldn't.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Susan. Thanks. You're welcome. Welcome. Thank you.